Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, The Burden of Genius. Writer Ethan Kanan writes about a fictional mathematician tortured by his tremendous early success. His new book explores genius, its beauty, its difficulties, addiction, family dysfunction, how some of the greatest thinkers can perform beautifully in some arenas and disastrously in others. This hour, On Point author Ethan Kanan on his latest novel, A Doubter's Almanac. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you have a child, spouse, parent, colleague whose brilliance is also a burden? Have you felt the pressure yourself to live up to a gift? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Iowa City, Iowa, is Ethan Kanan, professor of English and creative writing at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, author of the novels Carry Me Across the Water and America, America, and the short story collections Emperor of the Air and The Palace Thief. His new book, which the Los Angeles Times calls blazingly intelligent, is A Doubter's Almanac. The LA Times says it's an emotionally explosive exploration of success and failure in a family roiled by genius. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ethan Kanan joins us from Iowa City. Ethan Kanan, welcome. Great to have you right here.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Genius. Is that what you set out to write about?
No, not at all. I set about to write about just a guy in the woods. You know, novels are, like most discoveries, they are, in fact, unknown when you begin. You know, there are few scientists, I think, who would say they set out to discover what they discovered. And I think few novelists would say they wrote the novel they intended to write. This all surprised me.
But to set out with a kid in the woods and end up deep in algebraic topology, which I have to admit, I had no idea what that was.
Yeah, topology. It's sort of an obscure field of math. It's basically sort of super modern geometry.
Okay. What was it between you and the empty page that was whistling you toward topology?
You know, it's a funny thing. It starts out with just a kid who's like a lot of kids who had something of a lonely childhood. He grew up in the woods of Michigan, and the only world he knew was the world of himself and nature. And a lot of kids who are raised that way, strange that I've come across in my life, kids who are raised on farms, kids who are homeschooled, kids who somehow don't get into the educational system early, don't really understand the limits they're supposed to feel. And this kid on his own sort of begins to discover mathematical things as a child. And I myself have loved math all my life. It's really a thing of exquisite beauty, and I kind of wish it weren't thought of as a piece of drudgery or difficulty, because it's really one of the most exquisite things ever invented or discovered, depending on how you look at it, by man.
There's math here, but there's also the origins of genius early in your book. And then we get into really the far extensions of genius and its maybe disillusion before we're all over. But take us to that kind of, the kid in the woods, just goofing around, as all kids do, but goofing around and genius emerging in the midst of that in an unexpected way. Could you read a little bit for us? Milo Andretti is 13 years old there, and there's a hunk of wood in the woods. He sets to work on it.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned he's 13, because I went over and over this with my copy editor, because it's in his 13th year, and we actually realize that when you're in your 13th okay. year, you're actually 12.
Yes, excuse me. 12.
As long as we're being mathematically accurate on this show.
It's a good place to start.
So this is a kid growing up on the eastern coast of the state of Michigan, the western shore of Lake Huron. One night during the summer of his 13th year, a windstorm swept down the straits and he was awakened in bed by a crashing from the woods. The next morning, at the edge of a ravine, he came across a stump that was as wide across as a tractor tire. It was a beech tree broken off at the level of his waist. The rest of the tree lay several yards away, neatly divided into three, as though the immense thing had been scissored up, carried off to a safe distance, and placed down for his inspection. He took a seat on the rim of the broken base. For the whole morning, he sat there contemplating what had presented itself to him until an inspiration arrived. He spent the rest of the summer executing his idea. Over the long days of July and the shorter ones of August and September, he hardly came in from the forest. He found that he could work for 10 or even 12 hours at a stretch, so that by the time fall arrived, he realized that he'd produced something miraculous. It was a single, continuous loop of wooden chain, more than 25 feet long, carved out of the top of the stump and resting above it on hundreds of tiny spurs that had been whittled down to the thickness of finishing nails. The chain coiled in a tightening spiral toward the center of the tree, then doubled back and coiled out again toward the rim, returning to the spot where the last link closed around the first. He'd carved a twist into each of the links, which produced a startling effect. If he ran his finger all the way around the surface of any single one of the links, the finger would circle not once, but twice around the twisted link before returning to its starting point. This strange fact felt like a secret to him. Finally, one peat-scented evening in the warm October of 1957, he understood that he'd finished. He'd needed his creation to be perfect, and now it was. One last time he ran his hands over the length of it, feeling for flaws. Then he severed the spurs and meticulously sanded away their nubs. At last, he lifted the whole thing into his arms, doubling it around and around to shoulders until the slack was gone. It felt like a living thing now, yet it was as smooth and heavy as stone. When he inhaled, it tightened around his chest. Standing in the quietly darkening woods, as the lights began to come on in the distant house, he felt like an escape artist preparing a feat.
Ethan Kanan, reading there from his new novel, A Doubter's Almanac, about a 12-year-old, perhaps. perhaps his discovery of genius in a funky summer undertaking in the woods, carving a chain.
That has so much to do, actually, with what people call genius. Because for me, that little episode of carving a chain is really not about genius, but it's about concentration and mania and doing the undoable thing simply because of drive, which is love and concentration. And that's what this kid has. He has love and concentration.
Well, I was about to ask you, what is genius? Maybe you've just defined it. Maybe it's concentration and mania and doing the undoable thing. Or do you have a better definition?
You know, I don't. It's a kind of an overused word. But if you look through the history of sort of savants, one thing I like, Ramanujan, the great Indian mathematician who learned most of what he learned, he discovered a lot of the math that had been taken centuries before to be discovered. He discovered as, a 10, 11-year-old kid sitting on a wooden floor in India, and was later taken under the wing of a British mathematician named Hardy. But so much of it seems to be love, seems to be this idea that one can concentrate with a laser-like grip on the thing that one adores. And, the consequence of that is that you often then, you can't button your shirt right. You don't think about that, or you leave your keys in the car or let them fall down the gutter. That's sort of what happens to a lot of people with such concentration.
Love is the heart of genius, and yet the sort of character in your book here, Milo Andret, love, I mean, this guy, he may be a genius, but he's a real bastard, including to his family.
Well, I know, and that's said, and I guess he does what, nowadays they call bad choices. He makes a lot of bad choices.
That's such a kind of forgiving framing, isn't it?
Isn't it? Okay. He made a few bad choices.
Yeah.
I love this character, because the things he does wrong, he does out of pain. And I think that's something that, as one gets older, one realizes that most mistreatment comes from pain. I worked, I don't know if you mentioned it, but I was also a physician for a number of years. And I did a lot of work in big city emergency rooms where you are encountering and putting your hands on and listening to people who have made so-called a lot of bad choices. And what you see overwhelmingly is that so much of this is done out of pain. And I can forgive this man for everything he does. I happen to love him.
Would you describe, for our listeners, many of whom will not have read the book, the beauty of Milo's genius and the ugly face of it? Just give us a sense of those two.
Well, he's blessed with a couple of talents. One is that he has sort of an internal GPS that allows him to navigate the world, to always know where he is and to sort of see the world as a shifting set of coordinates, and he's at the center of it, which is a great topological gift. He also happens to be a fantastic drawer. He can draw things. And that particular talent, I've always been struck by people who can draw, because in some ways it's very much akin to idiocy. I don't know if you can draw it, I'm very bad at it. When I look at a head, I see a head, and I know it's a head, and I know it's supposed to be this shape. But I think that what artists, or a lot of great visual artists have, is they don't have that rational overlay. They don't know it's shaped like a head. They actually see it for what it is. So that sort of genius is a kind of idiocy. Some of the great discoveries that have been made, say Einstein's discovery of, or Einstein's derivation of the theory of relativity, had a lot to do with him saying the obvious thing, which is that time is supposed to be constant, and him saying to himself, well, it doesn't work if time is constant, so maybe time isn't constant. And that, in a way, genius as it is also idiocy, isn't it?
He solves a famed mathematical challenge early on in his career. He's celebrated at Princeton, but he ends up being so vile that he's more or less driven out of Princeton.
Yeah, he ends up making some very bad choices. A lot of it, I mean, he's a drinker, and you know, he drinks, and when you drink, to excess like that, your demons come right out, and he's a victim and an indulger of his demons.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Ethan Kanen about his latest, A Doubter's Almanac, a story of genius in the family, in this case, math genius, and its price, the textures and glories and pitfalls of that life, his version of it anyway. Ethan Kanen joins us from Iowa City, Iowa. He teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop there. You can join us this hour. Have you read Ethan Kanen since way back in Emperor of the Air? Are you surprised to find him writing about genius, these travails? Have you had genius in the family? How did that go? Give us the ups, the downs. When was it marvelous? When was it not? Of course, genius, 2001, Russell Crowe played game theorist John Nash, also at Princeton, struggled with schizophrenia. Here's a little scene from that movie where Nash's Dr. Rosen, Christopher Plummer, tries to help him.
It's a problem with no solution. And that's what I do. I solve problems. That's what I do best.
This isn't math. You can't come up with a formula to change the way you experience the world.
All I have to do is apply my mind.
There's no theorem, no proof. You can't reason your way out of this.
Why not? Why can't I?
Because your mind is where the problem is in the first place.
From A Beautiful Mind, Ethan Kanen is with us from Iowa City. Are you suggesting in your book, Ethan, that there is mental illness at play with John Nash? We were shown there certainly was.
You know, it's not something I would ever suggest or make light of, or even make generalizations about. But this guy—I
mean,
has,
to do none of those.
Yeah, and I understand. But this guy has a ferociously strong mind. This character, Milo Andrade, has a ferociously strong mind. And most people, I think, have had the experience at some point in their lives of feeling that they can't quite control their minds. You know, either with anxiety or thought. You know, you wake up at night and you can't quite stop your mind from doing what it's doing. And you get a glimpse in those moments that, well, gee, maybe I'm not really in control of this thing. And imagine that linked with actually a ferociously powerful mind and what that must feel like. I had the experience, I teach at the Iowa Writers Workshop, so I teach a lot of terrifically talented kids. And I had the experience a number of years back of having a really ferociously talented guy have a psychotic break when he was here, but he could feel it coming on. It wasn't a sudden thing. He maintained his rationality, and he would call me and say, you know, I could feel my mind slipping out of my control. And it was one of the most poignant, terrible things I'd ever been witness to. Unfortunately, he recovered, but just, you know, imagine that feeling, and that's what it feels like, I think, for this fellow. He's not, you know, Nash was probably a schizophrenic, My guy is not. I mean, my guy is, he drinks a lot. And when you drink like that, and especially when you get liver disease, it actually affects the mind. And you sort of, it takes the clamps off, takes the editor off the mind. And in a way, that's what geniuses search for, but it's also the cost of it.
Read us one more little bit. When his professor, and here he's in graduate school at Berkeley, is warning him, in a way, unexpectedly, about his great gift, his gift for math.
Yeah, and they're talking about another mathematician in the book who's actually invented his name. Mm-hmm. His name is Lars Holmgren. Mm-hmm. And Borland is his advisor at Berkeley. Borland is a professor, very famous mathematician. Mm-hmm. Borland leaned forward. Look, he said, you have a talent, Andred, a significant one. Maybe like Holmgren's, maybe like mine. That's perfectly okay to say, by the way, if it's true. Do you agree with me? I can't say, said Andred. This is what I'm trying to tell you, Andred. I can say. You've been chosen by God, young man, by humankind, by the cosmic order, by whoever you think runs this place, to translate a language. Topology is God's rules, Andred. That's what I'm telling you. And you've been called upon to translate them. He tapped the desk. Your talent is that major. Well, thank you, Professor. I'm grateful. Borland looked across the desk again, this time blinking. He poured himself another sherry. If you're grateful, he said, chuckling once more and turning back to his work, then perhaps you misunderstand.
If you're grateful to be told you have genius, perhaps you misunderstand. Ethan Kanen reading from his new book, A Doubter's Almanac. Let me ask you this. We've got listeners responding on here. Mari writes, she says, we don't do kids any favors when we slap the label genius on them. The old term idiot savant may actually be kinder. The pressures talented people put on themselves, she writes, trying to live up to unrealistic expectations of others can be deadly. I hear the professor has just laid it on him. Is it kinder to name it and frame it or not? And what do you have a sense or a reaction to this? Don't label people kids geniuses.
Well, I personally have a sense that genius is a very solitary thing. And one of the attributes of it is an internal world that is fully fabricated and much larger than the internal world many of us can build for ourselves. And that gets impinged upon when geniuses are made public. I mean, everything these days is for public consumption. And I think that's particularly hard for people who can construct a world inside their heads.
Here's another listener, Gerald, who says, really? The problem with higher math is that nothing usually comes close to it, like a new heroin user or a hero or heroine rudely plucked out of heaven. Daily life, I guess, beyond, higher math can be a real disappointment after higher math.
Yeah, I love that. I love that sentiment. I mean, mathematics, I think we'd sort of unfortunately make the mistake of teaching calculus in high school. And I think people who are pretty good at math kind of end up in calculus. Calculus isn't interesting enough, but it doesn't have, say, the fantastic knocking over quality that, say, algebra does, where you can – I mean, most of us learn algebra in high school, and it's really this exquisite thing. I mean, I'm thinking of, river problems. Do you ever do a river problem, Tom, when the boat can go 5 miles upriver, it takes 10 minutes, and the same distance the river, it takes, four minutes to go downriver, how fast is the current moving? Mm-hmm. So, here's this thing. You learn, you write it down. You make these variables, X's and Y's, and you write it down. And the crazy thing is that whatever the water molecules in that river are doing to the boat, God or the universe or whatever you want to call it, is doing to X and Y on a piece of paper, and you get the same answer. And you get this glimpse that, this mathematics is all around you.
It's the cosmos at work.
It's the cosmos at work. And sometimes I look out and I see I almost think I see the air molecules, and you can sort of think of them as numbers bouncing off each other. And I think that's what, people who love math feel. And there's a debate among mathematicians as to whether math is discovered or invented. And I certainly come down on the side that it's discovered, that it's out there, and we are merely looking and looking until we see closer behind the cloak of whoever it is who runs this place.
Ethan Koenig's new novel is A Doubter's Almanac, and we have much more to explore on the front of genius. We have a lot of callers for you as well, Ethan, from around the country. Let me go to Kennesaw, Georgia, and Alice. Alice, you are on the air with Ethan Koenig. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi.
Hi, Alice.
What's your story, Alice?
I just wanted to say that I think labeling a child as a genius can be a huge disadvantage to some degree. As a child, I was tested to a genius IQ. I was routed into all the genius programs. And my academic performance has reflected that. But the problem is that when you have someone, you label them as a genius, you set their bar at a genius level, and they have to go so much farther in order to prove themselves successful to everyone else.
Alice, this is kind of what this book is about, actually. It's about that idea that you set impossible standards. But there's also the flip side of that, which is that if you're lucky, if you can get through that first difficulty, it's actually the striving that one loves and one can learn to love, and that the striving that remains constant, the striving for something that you particularly love, not the success, but the mathematics or the science or the art or the music. And that's what remains constant.
Did that work out for you, Alice? It doesn't exactly work out for everybody in Ethan Koenig's book. How about you?
I think that in the cases when it does work out, then it's a wonderful thing. But I also think that it can carry huge social problems with it. I didn't have academic problems. I've gone above and beyond. I have a stellar academic record. But I'm approaching my late 20s, and I'm only just now going out and learning how to operate in a social setting. I don't think that I could even say at this point I have a best friend, because I feel people are intimidated around me, feeling like they might not be up to my level, and I have a lot of trouble going out and socializing, just because growing up, everything was, you have to perform, you have to reach this bar, you have to do this, you have to do that. Mm-hmm. You can't be an average, normal person.
Yeah. Alice, I'm glad for your testimony. And if I may take it to Ethan and to the book, I mean, it is very clear in this book that the laying on of this mantle of genius, yes, in a way, it's something to be celebrated. But inside Milo Andrit's family, where they've witnessed his and everything around it, there's enormous misgiving around this. It's a blessing, but they see it very clearly as a curse. His own son resists taking the mantle, though he's got the stuff.
Yeah. And this, you know, this question of inheritance is one that will dog everyone. You know, one thing about life is that it does, in my experience, get a little easier. And I think that, Alice, yours probably will too, as these things sort of fade a little bit. You know, the one thing about those who are labeled geniuses, they're often surrounded by others who make life easier for them. And that's what this man has around him, a lot of people who make his life easier. And there's, you know, I think there actually is some envy for people who are entirely self-contained, who don't need a social world. You know, and for those who actually do make physical or human connections, emotional connections, there's a little bit of envy, I think, even though there's also a lot of pity for people. There's certainly some envy for anyone who can be can make enough of a world in his own mind to live entirely alone within it.
But Milo's social problems are manifold, and he makes life pretty darn miserable for some of the very same people who help make his better. Are you suggesting that that's somehow part and parcel, or is that just this family and this story that Ethan Koenig pulled out of the ether?
Yeah, this is a single story. This is, you know, there's nothing generalizable about that. You know, he's got people who care about him deeply. He's often treats them poorly, but it's just one guy. And I think you really can't generalize. There's so many types of genius. There's so many types of averageness. There's just everything under the sun. It can hardly be grouped together.
Sam in Pompano Beach, Florida. Sam, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Ethan Koenig.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi, Sam.
My my experience with this affliction or blessing, as it was tempered by the fact that I have attention deficit disorder. So for my entire life, I have felt like I've got this howitzer. I just can't aim it. And it's been very, very frustrating. I joke to people, and I grew up in I was born in the 40s, and we didn't discover this until I was in my 50s and all the way through law school. So I was able to successfully jam 19 years of schooling into 24 years.
The ADD way. So on balance, Sam, a blessing or a curse or a confusion, this?
Depends on what time of day and whether the meds are working, I suppose.
Yeah, ADD is, ADD is sort of a somewhat recent diagnosis, and I think it's probably overly broad at this point. You know, it's described so many different things. And in a funny way, it almost seems to reverse back on itself, where it's phenomenal concentration that causes that, or that seems to be related to that.
But the howitzer that Sam can't aim, does that ring true to you or your imagination, Ethan?
You know, it feels like, this man at least has a howitzer, and all he does is aim it. You know, my character, that's what he does. He spends his life aiming this howitzer, and everyone else is walking around cooking dinner and, making the beds, and he's still aiming that howitzer. So in some ways, it feels opposite to what this guy does.
Speak about ambition in that regard. Is it because he's helpless to lay off the aiming, or he is not immune within his genius to, all the wonders of being seen as wonderful, of accomplishing great things, of solving insoluble problems? Is that worldly ambition? Is that something the genius itself produces?
I think they're unrelated, but that's what this book really is about. It's about ambition. It's about ambition and what it takes, what kind of toll that takes on the individual and what kind of toll it takes on the family, and whether that can be forgiven. And in a way, it's a book about any difficult character and whether you can forgive a difficult character in your family and find love for someone like that. His ambition is a fire that burns within him all his life, even as his talent declines.
Which takes him off into some pretty funky territory.
Especially for a mathematician. I mean, mathematicians like gymnasts tend to do their work very early. And there's a whole curse to that, to being in that field. That's not always true. There's some famous mathematicians like Leonard Euler who, is writing papers into his 70s, I believe. But most mathematicians have this feeling that if the work isn't done by your mid to late 20s or 30s, then you've lost the athletic skill and sort of the athletic skill of your neurons or the imagination that it takes to create something great.
Does he know in this brew of ambition and drink and genius, when he's in the groove, there's no difference between that when he's like on the trail of genius breakthroughs or when he's just, just tripping?
Well, he does. And that's the thing. In my experience, everybody who does this kind of thing has a sense of intuition, and it's crazy. I think if you ask scientists, and maybe there's some scientists out there listening who can comment on this, they can be working on unfathomable problems, problems they cannot understand, yet something tells them from inside the shell of the mind that, yes, you're correct. Yes, you're correct here. Keep going with this. And I feel that as a writer, you get, there are a lot of false paths, but then when you stumble on the right one, there's something inside you that tells you you're right long before you understand really how you were right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Ethan Kanan about his latest A Doubter's Almanac, story of genius in the family, math genius, and maybe its price. Where do you see genius in your world? How's it look? It's been depicted in all kinds of ways, in literature, in film, your 1956 film Lust for Life. Kirk Douglas plays the troubled painter Vincent van Gogh.
I'm in a cage of shame and self-doubt and failure. Somebody, believe me, I'm caged. I'm caged. I'm alone.
The genius painter there, 1996 film Shine, based on true story. Jeffrey Rush plays the Australian piano genius, David Helfgott, who later in life was institutionalized for mental illness. Here's a scene there where he joins a woman at the piano.
My name's Beryl Alcott. What's yours?
Alcott, that sounds a lot like my name. Helfgott, that's my name, Beryl.
Helfgott?
That's right, ridiculous. It means with the help of God. It's ridiculous.
What's your first name, Mr. Helfgott?
Ridiculous. Oh, your first thing's first, Beryl. David, I'm David. David, that's
right. You're David Helfgott?
That's right, Beryl, that's right, that's right, that's right.
But I used to watch you win all those competitions.
Win some, lose some, you can't lose them all. It's not your fault.
I was quite a fan.
The blithering genius depicted there in Shine. You know, there's a bit, Ethan, from A Daughter's Almanac, where you describe Milo's mind at work, trying to get into, he's solved one great problem, and he's got another that he's famously going at year after year, the Abendroth problem. He solved the Malos problem, but this one, he's having trouble. I wonder if you'd read, just give us a sense of a mathematician in the field of topology, trying to find his way in with all his genius to this problem.
By the beginning of his fifth year in the problem, his energy was clearly flagging. His morning drink generally tired him now rather than revitalized him, and on the days when he taught, he began napping at home after lunch. Now and then, on such afternoons, he didn't return to the office at all, but went to find DeWitt Tread. What remained to be discovered on the proof was still formidable, indeed daunting. He considered himself flexible in his attack now. His approach had moved from pure visualization to a mix of visualization and figuring. But what he couldn't deny was that a certain sameness had entered his work. The methodical approach itself, somehow, had become an end. The hours of thought, the incremental charting and drawing. As though by performing them both, even for brief periods, he could systematically check off the set of steps that would in time deliver a solution. Like a man moving a load of gravel with a wheelbarrow. He knew this was absurd. He knew that fortune of the kind he sought was chimerical and couldn't be plundered by method alone. Brilliance, luck, a moment of godly imagination. He would need all these things, but like every mortal, could do nothing to summon them. He could only hope, as he sat silently at his desk, that one of them might one day make a wary visit. He was aware that he'd set a course for a shore he might never reach.
Is that it? Genius is like some magic that you have to summon? Can't tough it out, grind it out?
People think about mathematics or mathematical geniuses, and they think of people who are able to do phenomenal calculations in their brains, and that might be part of it, but really what it is about people who find a different route in. That's where the thinking of people who are called geniuses, I think, really is. It's not about accreting or not about building up the hours, but it's about looking at the same thing everybody else has seen and seeing a new way into it. And that's what mathematicians try to do. Mathematics is actually an extremely creative field. It has everything to do with making the difficult easy, not with slogging through the difficult. It's making the difficult easy.
Nick in Verscher, Vermont. Nick, you're on the air with Ethan Kanin.
Hello, Tom. Ethan, thank you so much. I think that this kiss of genius can be a very radiant world. I think discipline, exercise, and a lack of alcohol is very important to sort of accentuate those gifts, because they can numb the senses and they can frustrate the individual very much. I also think math is extremely creative. And I wish today in the humanities, in the arts, we had sort of a more rigor like we did in the 19th century and sort of a more universal standard so that the two fields could again communicate.
That's a lovely thought, Nick. You know, one of the things, I don't know if you're a math type at all, but one of the things that convinces me that math is discovered rather than invented is that you can approach any problem, and all mathematicians know this, that no matter how you approach it, you can look at it from a topological point of view or a number theory point of view or algebraic point of view, you'll always get the same answer, that's the glimpse of God that mathematicians are talking about. No matter how you come around to it, you always get the same thing. And in the humanities, that's not the case. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find any two fields that have ever come up with even a similar answer to this, to the same question, which in some ways is what makes that interesting for certain people. But in other ways, is frustrating to those who seek some grace in their thinking.
So what about that? Nick says, let's have some more rigor in the humanities so we can measure genius or recognize it when we see it. I mean, does the genius in humanities and in math, are they part of the same cloth to your mind, having written this? Do they recognize one another?
You know, I don't think that's not the kind of rigor that I would think about, that we could to recognize genius and not recognize genius. It's an arbitrary cut point. I don't see the purpose of that. But to be able to agree on some standards of, say, one of the things that is interesting, I think, and not a lot of people realize, say literature, say writing novels. It's really something that we have learned over the centuries to do it better. Just the same way, before Brunelleschi, people didn't know how to make one thing look, the artist Brunelleschi, who invented what they call linear perspective. Mm-hmm. Artists didn't know how to make one thing look like it was further back from the other. They would try all kinds of tricks, and they would, make it cloudy and that kind of stuff. And then there was sort of this mathematical discovery that there's a vanishing point and things in the distance could follow these lines out to the front of the canvas. And it's the same way with great art. As we move forward, artists build on what others have learned before them. And, what I think is happening in the arts, say in our decades of this century, is that artists are, at least in writing or novelists, are trying to learning how to more closely mimic what it is to actually be alive, what the process of thought is. And prose becomes much closer to the instrument of thought, which is a very complicated idea. I've been spending some time about, trying to think how we actually do think. And it's not verbal. Words are sort of the after effect description of thoughts that go on and sensations that go on from living in the world. But they're certainly not your thoughts. And the novels that I love, the art that I love, more closely approximate the sense of being alive in the world.
It may take some genius to fully nail that one down. Libby and
Mike. Let me be more specific about that. If you're looking at the door, somebody walks in, you have a whole series of complex thoughts. Who is this person? Friend, enemy? But those are not in your mind as words, nor they're probably in your mind as pictures.
Figuring that out with the analogy of figuring out perspective in a painting, I get it. Libby in Miami. Libby, you're on with Ethan.
Hi.
Hi, Libby.
I wanted to share with you, I was tuning in and I heard you saying about this whole geniuses and have their own world built within their mind. And I'm thinking, that's my son. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's seven. And he was, tested and all this stuff. And they're calling it gifted, same, whatever. He's in first grade, but, his reading and his math is extremely advanced. And he solves problems and he writes books and he really enjoys it. But it seems like all the rest of us in the family are kind of on the sidelines of whatever he is doing. And when we try to have him interact or be part of the family or even consider, hello, us that are around you, pick up your own mess, it just goes by him. He doesn't.
That particular problem is not limited to Jesus.
There's other people living within his vicinity that do want to be a part of his life, not just serve him. That we want to interact with him as well, and we also want his cooperation in stuff that are important for us as a family.
Libby, the frame of that comes right out. Could be right out of the middle of Ethan Kanan's novel. I mean, it's the same for his family. What can you share, Ethan, for Libby?
Well, that's a very, very painful experience and ongoing, and one, a great difficulty that certain people have to face and learn and hope to improve. But I fully feel that, the pain of that situation. I suppose perhaps it's some comfort that for your seven-year-old son, it might not be painful, that living in one's own world can actually be immensely satisfying and pleasurable. But unfortunately, for those around someone like that, it can be endlessly difficult and pain, and a lot of pain.
Endlessly? Can you picture a point at which that young man becomes more aware of the sacrifices and presence of his family and their interests?
People do change a great deal in this. This book is about a man who eventually, in fact, late in his life, he begins to acknowledge those around him in some ways as though the great fire of his passion for mathematics finally recedes and he's finally able to see those around him. Is it too late? Is it too late for them to forgive him? That's in some ways what the book is about, and I think different readers take that answer differently.
Libby, we wish you well. We wish you very well. You sound promisingly self-aware about the whole thing. Andrea, also in Miami. Andrea, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Hello, Ethan. My comment is about genius and its relationship with schizophrenia. My husband had a PhD in applied mathematics from Cambridge University by the age of 28, as well as three master's degrees. Mm-hmm. And his thesis was returned to him with zero corrections.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
He can look at reams and reams and reams of numbers, and he sees pictures. Just mm-hmm. as some people hear sound and see colors.
Mm-hmm.
It's for him as visceral as that.
Yeah.
But where did he gain this gift or learn this skill? His father was a violent and abusive paranoid schizophrenic, and my husband's childhood was incredibly difficult. He was told that he would grow up one of two ways, either healthy or himself a paranoid schizophrenic.
Mm.
And in his home life, he grew up in Canada, and at that time, the philosophies will keep these mentally ill people in the home and allow them to have their rights and live with their families. The victims of these very ill people were very much abused, like my husband. He learned to observe the world to protect himself from his father. His genius is partially derived from needing to survive his father's schizophrenia.
Did he escape schizophrenia himself, Andrea?
Yes, but he did not know that that would be the case until he was 40 years old. Therefore, he lived, and he's today 45, incidentally, he lived the bulk of his life and his academic career believing that any moment this incredible mind that he had may any day turn on him.
Yeah.
And in fact, everything that he was building and living and learning and finding fascinating about life and mathematics might erode.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing to fear.
And apparently, this is incredibly common. Schizophrenia also comes with a lot of infertility. And it seems that those who are studying schizophrenia and fertility, they see it very frequently. It seems as though it may be the disease's way of controlling itself in the population.
Wow. Andrew, let me ask you, our time is short. Is he ultimately grateful for this genius with that whole package or something else?
Yes. And he is actually very well adjusted and very good at interacting with the world. He's not a withdrawn person, but he is constantly in his daily life, adjusting to people's behaviors, other people's level of intelligence, and how it he's just basically completely on a different mental plane and has to constantly sort of course correct because the rest of the world doesn't operate on the same level that he works on.
Andrea, I'm so glad for your call. Wow. Ethan Kanan, it's as if there's one affirmation after another calling in here of different facets of the story you tell in A Daughter's Almanac. This is not terra incognita to people. People live in this realm of genius and its implications.
Yeah, and as we were saying before, the idea of most of us have had the experience fleetingly of not being able to control the mind. You know, often it's at night, often it's waking up at 3 a.m, worry about your next day at work or something that was said, and I'm not being able to turn that off. And, you know, for a man like Andrea's husband, with that kind of history and that kind of forceful mind, he's aware of the monstrous strength of this thing that he's holding back, you know, with his narrow little reins, and it's got to be frightening.
How are you at recognizing genius? Do you know in 5 minutes, in 30 seconds, in 5 days, whether somebody's?
When I look at it, you know, it's funny. We are so attuned to language. I can usually tell within about 3 or 4 words of a book or 3 or 4 words of a story whether the writer has allowed himself to vanish and the character has allowed itself to emerge. And that's what makes a story for me.
Well, this is quite a story, getting quite a reception, and I congratulate you on having made your way through it, a journey in itself. Ethan Kanin, today with us from Iowa City, author of the new A Doubter's Almanac. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure for us, too. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.